This is Book Public from Texas Public Radio. I'm Yvette Benavides. On this episode, I'll be talking to Peter Mendelsohn about two books, his new novel, Weepers, and his memoir, Exhibitionist. Peter Mendelsohn, he's the creative director and a contributor at The Atlantic. On his website, he's described as a fledgling painter, a defunct graphic designer, and a recovering classical pianist. He's also the author of 7 books, including The Delivery and What We See When We Read. I say all this here by way of providing context for the wide-ranging discussion we had. Two books are our central focus here. Weepers is a novel. The protagonist is Ed. Ed is a weeper. He is a card-carrying member of a union of weepers hired to cry at funerals. This might seem like an unusual and surreal element of the story, but it really isn't. Weepers, or people who attend funerals for the purpose of crying, have existed a long time throughout the world. But in the case of this little town, the criers are a little bit burned out, and Ed, while a much-in-demand weeper, is dealing with a lot of other problems. When a young, strange kid comes to town, something happens that affects everyone, including Ed. In Exhibitionist, One Journal, One Depression, 100 Paintings, Mendelsohn offers us a unique memoir. In 2020, he had been in a profound depression, one that was even dangerous. When the pandemic descended on the world in the spring of that year, Mendelsohn was with his family, secluded in a farmhouse in New Hampshire. There, the depression took an intractable hold. This was a very different kind of depression for Mendelsohn, who had endured others throughout his life. This time, he'd been on the brink of suicide. He had a hard time focusing on doing the things he loved best, including playing the piano and reading. But one thing he suddenly could do was paint. This might not seem so extraordinary until you realize that he'd never been a painter. Something nameless pushes him to a Michael's craft store where he buys canvases and paints and brushes. He stows them in the trunk of his car for a very long time. But once he brought those materials out into the light and started painting in the barn on that farm, he found some form of relief. In some ways, he was pushed more deeply into a mind that contemplated suffering, his own and that of others. He comes to understand some of the mysteries of his enigmatic and troubled father, the admiration and love he feels for his mother, a woman who also suffered physical illnesses, deepens. The memoir includes the entries Mendelsohn was able to compose during a very dark and difficult time. He integrates 100 paintings, too. As we learn, he painted many more, because there was something life-saving about painting, this new sort of stand-in occupation. Rather than sit at the keyboard, at the piano, or at the computer, Mendelsohn stood before the canvas on the easel, and it kind of saved his life. In this discussion, we talk about other books too, his 2020 novel Delivery, and a 2014 book, What We See When We Read, which is a kind of talisman for this podcast host. Here now, my conversation with Peter Mendelsohn about many books, but mostly about his latest novel, Weepers, and the memoir, Exhibitionist, One Journal, One Depression, 100 Paintings. I stopped at 24 questions.
Oh, okay. I'm a fast talker, so.
Okay. I'm asking you questions about both of the new books, but I also have What We See When We Read in here. This is a book that I kind of carry around, but I'll try to control myself.
You have absolutely no reason to, and I will follow your lead, and whatever you want to ask is in bounds.
All right. Well, thank you. Tell us about Weepers. When people ask you what your novel is about, what do you say?
Like many of my novels, it's a hard elevator pitch, mainly because I both enjoy weird books and I also write slightly strange books. In this case, it's a story. I mean, in the briefest terms, it's a story about people who are paid to cry at funerals. And this is, in fact, a profession worldwide. It happens very rarely in the United States, but not only does it happen all over the globe, but it's been happening both in the East and the West for centuries and centuries. And you can read about it in the Bible, and you can read the Roman commentators on funerals, and it's a very, very old profession. But the magic realist conceit here is that it's a normalized profession in the United States. I said that was going to be a brief elevator pitch, and it kind of metastasized. I'm sorry.
No, it's great. And it's true. You know, when I was a little girl, this is TMI, because if there was a context where there was even a hint of a reason to cry, I would cry. And
that's wonderful, actually.
My mother would call me Maria Magdalena because Mary Magdalene, you know, she was on the scene weeping, you know, at the foot of the cross and other places.
Yes, of course.
And so my mother would say, "Ay, no, Maria Magdalena." So I think about that every time I cry. But anyway.
That's so interesting. I wonder, I mean, we don't have to excavate that on air, but it is interesting to me why that would be the case. And it would indicate to me, at the very least, that you are a sensitive human being, which is what this book is about. Sensitive human beings.
Sensitive human beings. And is this a blessing or a curse?
Well, it's both, isn't it? I mean, it's very, very hard to be emotionally open and empathetic. Specifically, I would say, in times such as these, when, you know, we're starting to see the signs of the death of the planet and the death of democracy, and it's just not so great out there. And so to leave your heart open is extremely difficult. And it's very tempting, I think, to harden one's heart and one's skin. And we can see around us, in fact, that there's a tremendous amount of anger in the world and a tremendous amount of numbness in the world. And I think that these are two while understandable responses to difficulty in life, they're not the most productive responses, which is to say that there is a service, I think, that sensitive people provide to the world. It's modeling compassion, but it's also painful. It's painful to take in so much, and to care for others is a great, I want to say it's taking on a great risk, the risk of heartbreak, not just yours, but to experience other people's. And so it is in fact a burden, which is why I think this book is in fact a messianic story, and is, aside from being about people who cry at funerals, is about one person in particular who comes to this town where these weepers are and has this sort of preternatural ability to draw feelings out of other people. And I think the idea of a Christ-like figure who can see deep into our hearts and can pull out of us these profound feelings, and who themselves are bearing burdens. That's the genesis of, no pun intended, of that particular structure for the book, is this idea of compassion as both a gift and a burden.
Tell us about these ideas with Ed.
So Ed is the narrator of the book, and he's been a weeper for most of his life, and he's older now and not particularly well and physically, and has also grown quite weary of his profession. Every day he comes in, he clocks in, he gets put on a job, he goes to whatever memorial or service he's put on, and he gets paid, and he squeezes out a couple tears and goes home to his sort of forlorn and lonely existence. For him, he's sort of reached a bit of a crisis point when the book begins. His life is very, very sad and also very, very dull. And he has sort of intimations of his own mortality. And then all of a sudden, this kid comes to town, and the weeping work starts to become, for want of a better word, exciting, because the whole community starts to feel more. And not only at funerals, this kid, who's only referred to as the kid in the book, as I said, has this sort of miraculous power. And so Ed is sort of writing this gospel of this kid's power and what it does to the community. And for him, it also awakens in him these memories of Ed's own childhood and the abuse he suffered at the hands of his father and some of the seeds of his deep-rooted sadness. So for Ed, all of this is something that he had kind of been awaiting without knowing he was awaiting it. And when it comes, these miracles, he's the first apostle.
Hmm. I've been thinking about how these are these card carrying, you know, union members.
Yeah.
And we work in places, and maybe this is true for you too, where there are people who work like workaholics, like they're really good at what they do and they never want to leave the office and they're always, you know, on it. And I was trying to think about the weepers in this community in this way too. I mean, it's just so interesting, even though, we, as you said, this is a true thing out there in some cultures. But the way that you use it in this book, it's very interesting to me where it's about work and the daily grind. And it's just fascinating to me. This is how my life happens sometimes. I'm reading a book and then I'll read something else that collides with it in an interesting way. So I happened to be reading Heinrich Böll's collected stories, and I came across the story, The Laugher.
I don't know it.
So this is a short story. The protagonist is a professional laugher.
And right. There's an analog in Weepers, actually.
Yes.
There's a young woman who's a motivator.
Can you talk about that?
I suppose the point is that of having this particular character, not just her name is Cindy, who is the kid's girlfriend, essentially. And the idea is that sadness isn't, as I said, the only productive emotion. I think laughter is also extremely important. And I wanted her as a foil, but I also wanted to make that point that people that can, who can generate joy are also extremely, extremely important. I remember a couple of occasions where over the last several years where laughter was sort of the only remedy for certain feelings that I was feeling in particular, and also certain feelings that we as a culture were experiencing. I remember the moment during the pandemic where nobody knew if it was okay to publicly laugh or have shows that could be funny. And this also happened, I remember, after the Twin Towers fell, and it took a moment until humor was sort of allowed back into circulation. And as soon as it was such a relief for everybody. And of course, it's a relief to cry. I mean, I've mourned several people who I've loved in my life, unfortunately. And there have been all kinds of experiences, especially when I was young and mourning was something that I was not particularly good at. And in fact, I think was avoidant of, as most people are when something terrible happens. It's often the case that when someone dies, I've noticed that the people around the deceased tend to fight, because anger, as I said before, is a much easier feeling to feel than sadness. And so, you know, I had very confusing mourning experiences. This year, my mother passed, and I'm old enough now and have done this enough so that I just allowed myself to sob. And really, whenever it came, I would just bring on the storm. And as a result, there was this very, very, it was a very healthy process. And it's one that felt like has been moving through me in a very deep, but also appropriate way, and in a very organic way. There's no skirting it, and there's no sort of transmogrifying it into some other toxic feeling. It's just simply sadness.
I'm so sorry for your loss.
Thank you. Thank you.
And I did read about your mother in your other book, Exhibitionist, which I want to ask you about as well.
Yeah.
The idea of the laugher, as I was thinking about it while reading Weepers, you know, it's the character. The more he laughs, the more disconnected he is from joy and happiness.
Right. And the busman's holiday.
Yeah. And I mean, you can imagine this is about a lot of things. The irony of it, it's about identity, it's about authenticity. And there's also a history of professional, you know, laughers or jokers, as you know, but just as there is for Weepers. And I mention all this only as a note about Böll's story that I just tripped over while I was reading Weepers. It's kind of this interesting fraternal twin, you know, to the idea of Weepers. And so, you know, Exhibitionist is a big book. Weepers is not quite as big. And the Heinrich Böll's collection is a cinder block. So I've just been like carrying like these massive, wonderfully massive books around
I'm so
together.
sorry. It's good for your forearms. It's interesting, The Bowl. I'll have to go read it now. I think that there's a bit of a tradition, come to think of it, of books about people who take on some aspect, some very, very deep aspect of our humanity and put it on display for other people. I'm thinking of Kafka's Hunger Artist in particular right now. And that these people are doing something not just in service of trying to foment more of it, but actually doing it for other people so that other people don't have to do it. You know, the Hunger Artist is taking on this kind of asceticism. And putting it on display, and in a way, he's an analog for the artist, you know, the artist who delves deep, who has to take on these difficulties. And there's something monkish about it, in the sense that, you know, Zen monks will go to a village with a begging bowl and they'll be given rice, and the idea is that they're doing the spiritual work on behalf of the village, and so are re remunerated for it. So it seems like your laughter book and the Weeper's book and the Hunger Artist book, there is a constellation there that I find very interesting.
Oh, I agree. I agree with that. Well, I want to ask you something. So let me switch gears, and if it's okay with you, and talk a little
Course.
bit about the exhibitionist.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the many things I love about this book too is that you refer to Anne Truitt, whom I admire very much, even though she described making artists not knowing where I was going, but knowing how to get there. And for you, you said, I had no idea where I was going and no idea how to get there. The only thing I knew was that I arrived. And I like this idea about how you set about to paint and move in this kind of a different space. I mean, you are a book designer. You are very many things, Peter. You play
Guilty.
a classical pianist. There's just so much that you do, and you're a novelist, etc. And I was thinking about how during the pandemic, as you write about in Exhibitionist, you this is in entry 7 on page 14. You say, I do not think I will ever be able to write again. I despair over this before realizing, reading these few entries over, that I am writing. The sentences here are like the ones in my fiction, using the same vocabulary, rhetoric, rhythms, a habit, I suppose. And then you went out to a bookstore, a 45-minute drive away, which I found interesting, but also I get it. But you didn't buy a book, and you left, and you went to Home Depot. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about. I'm very interested in this, the idea of synesthesia, which you also write about in another book. And this is not exactly synesthesia, but this how you moved your creativity into a different space when you were really in the depths of, as you say, a very dangerous kind of depression.
Yeah, you know, I had the great fortune of studying classical piano for, you know, from my early childhood until my early 30s. And I really did assume that that's what I was going to do for the rest of my life. I had the misfortune of not being in that top tier where you actually can make a decent living doing it. So I developed all of these skills and I spent my entire life at the keyboard and then all of a sudden had to pivot. And then I was very fortunate to find that I could design and that there was such a thing as graphic design, which I hadn't known. I mean, I didn't really think about any other career when I was a pianist. I barely thought I would be able to get a job as a temp. But my daughter was born, we needed health insurance. I ended up designing. Long story short, after designing for a while, I realized I really wanted to write. And so I did that. I'm in news media now. And I think that there is both a restlessness in me that means that I have to do some of this hopping from medium to medium, but also that kind of early on, I think because of the change from design to, I mean, I left out painting in there. In the move from music to design, I realized that there are certain common factors in making things, whether they're things to listen to or things to read or things to look at, that there are certain ways in which one recognizes patterns. And for instance, if you're learning a piano piece and you can see what the modulations are quickly, you're sight reading, you look and you see that there's a certain amount of arpeggios who go up or they go down, or you quickly can kind of grok at a glance what a piece of music is going to do. In the same way that if you're reading a book, I think as your eye sort of saccades around the page, you can kind of pick up very quickly where the author is headed before sort of looking at the more granular information. And with writing also, I think to sort of quickly get a sense, that's it. I think the speed of it is very important, that in order to be able to learn something and perform in that genre, it's very important to be able to see those patterns. And the thing about painting for me is that when I started doing it, it was for me alone, and no one knew I was doing it. And I had no ambitions, and I'd never painted before. And so I had no technique or no knowledge, but specifically didn't want to pick up any. That for me, painting was going to be the one space where I could just be an idiot. I can just slap the paint down on the canvas in whatever way I wanted to. And in some ways, the less I was there doing things, the better. The more I could remove myself from the process, the more productive it seemed to me. So that, painting is a weird kind of anomaly in that sort of series of jumps that I've made. And when I did actually come out of Home Depot and roll into that Michael's craft store and pick up those art supplies, it wasn't with the intention of actually painting or becoming a painter. It was completely unconscious urge. And I didn't actually get to the materials that I bought for a pretty long time. And when I did actually get to them and pull them into this barn and start painting, it was really in a dream state. And it took me quite a long time, by which I mean years, to understand why that actually happened, because it wasn't conscious, and it wasn't like the move from music to design or the move from design to prose. It was very much something deep inside of me trying to sort of army crawl my way out of this deep depression. And without even knowing it, I think I was, some voice deep inside of me was saying, like, you should look at color and shape and something that can keep your hands busy.
Because you weren't really able to even read.
No, I stopped reading right before the pandemic. The depression hit, I want to say, 4 months or so before COVID. And so I was really deep in by the time the pandemic even started. And yeah, I suddenly found myself unable to read. And that lasted for quite a long time. A couple of years ago, I started reading some small things. I was in a book club with just some wonderful people, and the books were all short, and I agreed to be part of that. And so I read those books. I haven't read a lot since. I'm really still kind of struggling with this problem of being able to read. I can play music again, and I can listen to music again, which was also something that went away that was particularly painful. But yeah, it's funny. It's a kind of blindness or deafness or some sort of impairment that the depression brought on. It's almost like when a depression is deep enough and dangerous enough that it rewires your brain in some way. I'm very thankful that I'm not in those depressive cycles anymore. Thank God. But one does wonder what the long-term effects of it can be.
You know, one of the most heartrending, I mean, and there are many, many moments in Exhibitionist, well, in Weepers as well. But it's this, that as a reader who loved to read all the time at one time, your books you describe had small hairs on them because you even read when the barber was cutting your hair. And I just love this detail, and I thought that is a lot to lose. And the other thing, on page 48 in entry 20, you say that you read professionally, a professional reader. And I thought, a professional reader, a professional laugher, a professional weeper. And it just seems so interesting to me. And how you found painting, how you were able to, if you couldn't read and you couldn't do these other things, that you could put that, I don't know what to call it, energy, effort, work, love, a kind of something.
Yeah. It was compulsive, actually, and I think it was all the things you mentioned, and it's so funny you picked up on the hairs in the books, because no one else has mentioned that to me. And what's funny about it is it felt, as I was looking through the journals and I saw that entry, it is one of the ones that affected me the most, and has never come up in a conversation about this book, but it did somehow seem. You know, one writes a journal in the way one writes a journal, and you don't expect there to be some sort of good writerly detail in it. But I think that, if I could pat myself on the back as a journal writer, that did, I found that affecting, and it was some sort of evidence for the fact that I was actually reading. I was reading as I walked to the subway, I was reading on the subway, I would read at work, I'd read before I went to bed. It was a very important part of my life. But yes, it did become professionalized. As music had, as design did, as writing to some extent has now. And I think painting, you're right to point out, was not professionalized. And I think in a way that's why it was so important that A, I wasn't being paid to do it, and I didn't have to do it, and there were no strictures. But also B, there was no, like I said before, there was no mandate that I get good at it or that I learn anything about it. It was simply just kind of art as, almost like a bodily process. It was like art is crying. Like it just comes out of you. And it's a reaction to, deep emotional states that I think, especially with the depression, were inaccessible to me. And so the art, just in the same way as I was saying when I was mourning my mother, that, you just simply cry. There's no mediation, there's no trying to stop it. It just happens. And that feels, I mean, I didn't feel great during those depressions, which were, as I said, reasonably dangerous. But there was something that was being relieved and released by that.
You say on page 10, entry 4, that you have a new novel coming out, which I take to be Weepers, a reference to Weepers, and you worry that people won't like your narrator. Why was this a worry?
It actually wasn't Weepers. It was my second novel, which was called The Delivery. And
I see.
yeah, it's a book about a kid, an immigrant who, this is before we had this sort of system of bike messengers who bring us food and everything that we could want in life at the push of a button on an app. But which really got going during the pandemic, the sort of deliveries that would take place during the period in which I was writing that book were the restaurant deliveries that were generally delivered by people of the same ethnicity as the restaurant, Chinese food. You'd get a Chinese delivery guy, and bike messengers who mostly were responsible for delivering, business envelopes and whatever. So I'd imagined this sort of world in which people would be delivering everything, and they'd be getting things from warehouses, and it was sort of a pre-Amazon imagining. And so I had this kid, and he's new to the country, and he's riding around on his bike, and for various reasons, he ends up on a sort of dangerous trip that takes him outside of the city, on his bike alone to make a kind of mysterious delivery. And somewhere in the middle of the book, the narrator starts to address the reader, and this seemed important to me to have in the book. I mean, I'm overcomplicated th things by explaining this, but it seemed important to acknowledge not just that I am writing about a person, a class of people who I myself, I do not belong to that community. And the narrator serves that function of being sort of a hedge against me seeming that I might have some particular expertise, but also, my grandparents, who I grew up with, were emigres, and they were also people who fled a war and who had to learn the mores of a new country. And so, anyway, I have this narrator, and he intrudes. And the early readers of the book, some of them absolutely loved that. It's this kind of Nabokovian or Calvino kind of conceit. Experimental in its own way, but some people found it really intrusive. And it was interesting, the reviews were really split on that, whether this was an interesting and clever conceit or whether it sort of just broke up the narrative too much. So I think what I was referring to in my journal was both this fear, and this was before the reviews, that people wouldn't like this dude. But also, the narrator is very much like me. He thinks kind of high-mindedly, and he gets very caught up in these sort of intellectual puzzles. And I just worried that people wouldn't like me and my proxy. And, I think at that time, with the depression in particular, I was just dealing with a lot of shame and a lot of dislike for myself. There was just a lot of self-hatred. So I think that's what was going on there. Sorry it took me so long. It was a long road to get to an easy point.
Oh, no. And I hope listeners will now look for this other book as well, and
It's the
read.
book I'm actually most proud of, and I think it did come out in, I want to say, the spring of that first year of the pandemic, and it really was not a good time to put a book out into the world, trust. I mean, you probably know. It just sort of fell into the void. But yeah, I am proud of it in retrospect, but I've always been slightly worried and slightly ashamed of just the ego that it takes to write a book and then assume people are going to read it.
Well, did you have that worry about Ed that people would not understand? Because I think about surreal elements in literature where I used to say to my, I used to teach English and creative writing. I would tell my students who were a little turned off by the surreal stories, I would say, oh, well, actually look in there more closely because that's where reality actually exists. Except it's a little bit like, enlarging a photo so much that you can't tell anymore what the image is until you turn it this way or that way, and then you find your
Sure.
center and you try to make sense of the outsized nature of it just to try to see what's there. And then it
Yeah.
comes into focus. But I don't know, I'm wondering how, I've been carrying your books around, as one does. And my colleagues here in the newsroom are like, "Weepers, what's that about?" And I'll start to say it, and it is kind of interesting and different for a lot of people who are listening to me go on and on about the book. But for them, they care nothing about the roots of it, or the that it has been a profession, or they don't want to know that. But
Right.
in terms of the here and now and this character, it is so surreal for them. But I feel like, I don't know. There is something there that helps us ask more questions. And that's what I'm sort of after all the time, is not the easy answers, but I like having more questions to try to ponder, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. I mean, I think we're birds of a feather that way. The truth about Weepers in its own way is that once you sort of get past that first surreal conceit that there are these unions of people who in the American Southwest or, Middle America or wherever it is, are just, it's very normal. You have a funeral, you have a service, you memorial. These people come there and they cry for you. I think once you accept that, the book in many ways reads in a sort of realist fashion. It's very interesting because, the book was excerpted in the Atlantic magazine and the excerpt was taken entirely from Ed's flashbacks, which are told in a perfectly realist manner. And one would get the impression reading that short story that the book is itself a very, very straight ahead book about a kid and abuse in the home. And but yeah, I am a fan. My favorite writers have always been the writers who will interrogate a little bit what it means to be alive. And is the world, in fact, the world that, in the sense that we talk about it, in the way that we've been taught to look at it, in the ways in which fiction presents it to us? And I think, mimetic realist fiction presents a picture of the world that is, that the ego is stable, that one thing happens after another, that we perceive the world, objects in it, we are subjects, we digest the objects in it, we learn things from our suffering and we grow, and there are comedies and there are tragedies, and we tell ourselves these narratives. But in a way, I don't actually believe that that's what life is in its deepest sense, the way that we apprehend it and perceive it, and the way the experience of living is. I think living is far more miraculous than that and far stranger. And so, I love to read Borges and Calvino and Cortázar and all of these writers who I think were very interested in finding ways to, Donald Bartholomew is a great example, finding ways to represent the stranger parts of life. And I think by doing that, maybe get at something that's slightly deeper than, well, my relationship isn't working out and it's been very hard for me. And in the end, this is what I learned about myself. I mean, that's reductive, but you know what I mean.
I do know what you mean.
Yeah.
Peter, can you tell me something about your mother and something about your father?
Yeah. My parents were lovely, wonderful, loving people who had to contend with some very difficult things. My father, first of all, was the son of two Holocaust survivors, my grandparents, his parents. He grew up in a household of survivors, escapees, immigrants, and looking through his letters that I've come across recently since my mother's death, I see that he was very, very much haunted, starting as a young boy, by the ghosts that he lived with. He grew up in the Bronx in an apartment that was filled with a lot of people in his nuclear family and otherwise, and also just chock full of the people who didn't make it out of the camps. And this affected him very deeply. And whether it was, I think, something that was situational or chemical, I don't know, but he could be a very depressive human being and also a very exuberant human being. I've been diagnosed with a bipolar condition, mood disorder, and I would, in retrospect, diagnose him the same way. He could be very angry and at times violent, and at other times just sort of uncontrollably exuberant. He also had a quite major brain tumor, which we weren't told about, my sister and I, and his mother wasn't told about. There was just a huge amount of secrecy around it. And it was both that the tumor would then exacerbate some of those tendencies in him, also the medications he was taking, which is a fair amount of barbiturates and steroids, which, will push you towards, violence and anger and instability. And so growing up in this household where there were these sort of mysterious forces and not quite knowing, as a friend of my father's put it to me, which Ben you were going to get at any given moment. And it was sometimes very challenging, the violence and the sort of intense critical lens that was brought to bear on me. And my mother was a beautiful, wonderful woman who was really trying to contend with all of this. And in the middle of it, my sister had left when she was a young teen, and I was alone in the house with my parents and my grandparents. And, during this time, my father tried a couple of times to take his own life. And, in the way in which you're a kid and you know things and you don't know things, I knew that my father, he had survived these attempts, but was in comas. And, there was all of this extreme sort of existential despair in the household that I could pick up on and was sometimes victim to, but didn't quite understand the roots of it all. And I still, it's hard to pick apart what was the tumor, what was the depression, what was, his pre, his just the way he was made. But, he passed away when I was 21. And like I said, that was a very complicated mourning because there was also a fair amount of anger mixed in there, some of which was justified and some of which wasn't. And my mother got sick very, very soon after that. She had cancer. I remember talking to the surgeon after, she'd gone in for a routine hysterectomy, and he came out and said, she's got cancer everywhere. She's metastasized everywhere. And she was in there for 9 hours. And by the time she came out, I was like, well, here goes the next parent. As it turns out, she got on top of it, but then later got Parkinson's. And it was sort of my sole responsibility to take care of her in her decline, which was painful and ugly. And Parkinson's is just a terrible disease. And I got to witness it very up close. However, there was also sort of the great gift of both becoming extremely close with her in a way that one does when one's almost like a child and a mother. There was a lot of physical contact. There was just deep intimacy, and I got to talk to her about my father and learn some things about his own challenges and difficulties and the challenges that my mother faced. And In Exhibitionist, in the journals, I'm trying to contend in the heart of this depression that I should say was one of many, many throughout my life, but definitely the worst one. I was trying to contend with who my father was, not just as a man, but as an artist, because he was an artist, and here I am painting all of a sudden, and I'm facing the blank canvas. I'm imagining in the ways in which he did, and suddenly these words of his are coming back to me about art and how it's made and how it's done. And much of it I sort of disagree with and repudiate once I'm actually making my own paintings, but still it becomes sort of a lens, my depression, his depressions, his rage, my rage, his art practice, my art practice. So in a way, the book is very much about sort of coming to terms with and meeting anew one's parents. Which is often necessary later in life.
Yeah. Thank you for saying that. Thank you for sharing that with me.
Of course, of course.
I'm going to read something to you from the book, What We See When We Read, because I'm just somebody who makes all these connections all the time, Heinrich Böll and who knows who else.
Please.
But you wrote, authors are curators of experience. They filter the world's noise, and out of that noise, they make the purest signal they can. Out of disorder, they create narrative. They administer this narrative in the form of a book and preside in some ineffable way over the reading experience. Yet, no matter how pure the data set that authors provide to readers, no matter how diligently pre-filtered and tightly reconstructed, readers' brains will continue in their prescribed assignment to analyze, screen, and sort. And then later in the same paragraph, you say, I would propose that this is why reading works. You talk about we take in as much of the author's world as we can and mix this material with our own in the alembic of our reading minds, combining them to alchemize something unique. I would propose that this is why reading works. Reading mirrors the procedure by which we acquaint ourselves with the world.
I haven't looked at that book since it first came out. I think that was 2014. It's
Yeah.
so crazy to hear one's own words that one has forgotten, one has written. Sorry to
Well,
interrupt you.
oh no, I come back to this book all the time when I'm reading just about anything or my notes in the margins. But, I was thinking about how just all of it, just is a weeper, an exhibitionist, an exhibitionist weeps. The reader co-creates. I mean, it's just so interesting to me, this whole kind of, can I call it a community or can I call it just a network of something? Maybe network sounds a little too cold. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. What do you think?
I mean, I think you're getting at a couple of things that I think are very interesting. One is that there is no solitary narrative in life, that we're all intertwined in this very deep way. And I think maybe one of the points that I was getting at, although I forget the context again for that particular piece of writing, is that you read a book and an author is providing something and you are providing the other something. And I think, if your listeners were listening to the story about my parents, which is a very personal story, one that has fine-grained details that I didn't get into that the readers may not know about. But in fact, I would wager that when people were listening to that story, that what they were both thinking about and applying to that story on some level is their own experience, their own, wonderful experiences of their parents, difficult experiences of parents coming to terms with whatever experience with their parents they might have had. They might even be picturing their own parents in their mind's eye that, co-creation is a good word, that we're all very embedded. This is one of the stranger things, like I was saying, about the way we experience life as opposed to the way that we, in most fiction, describe the way we experience life, is that in fact the ego isn't that stable, and it isn't in fact that walled off from other egos, that we live in, and I think a network is a fine word. I think we live in a network of souls, and we go in and out of each other's lives, and our ideas enlarge upon one another's and inflect upon one another, and they shade one another's thoughts and So I think that aspect is very important. I think the other thing in what you were saying that's interesting to me is that readers, if we are going to posit that there are sensitive people in the world, sensitives is how I refer to them sometimes, and that readers might be a classic case of a cohort there because we're interested in other people's lives. So we read about them and we inhabit them briefly. And, that ability to live inside someone's shoes for a minute is something that a reader has to have, and maybe what draws us to books. So that there is, in fact, this, and readers aside, poets and dancers and weepers and whoever else it is, that there is community there. There are people who, and I would say probably recognize one another much in the way that I would say that in this conversation, I've recognized you as a kindred spirit in the way you talk about life and reading and art, that we are a community, and whether we're recognized by a union or not, and whether we have a flag to fly or not, and we don't. Actually, that should be a design assignment. That we are, in fact, a community and a global one. And I think it's important that we recognize one another and that we be recognized for that work that we do, which is feeling deeply and caring about what somebody else feels.
And I certainly think your books can help this along. Peter Mendelssohn, thank you so much. What a thrill. I'm so
Thank you
happy I
so
got to
much.
talk to you. Thank
Yeah, it
you.
was a total pleasure. Thank you.
Peter Mendelssohn is the author of the novel Weepers and the memoir Exhibitionist, One Journal, One Depression, 100 Paintings. This has been Book Public from Texas Public Radio. Jacob Rosati composed our theme music. Dan Katz is Texas Public Radio's news director. I'm Yvette Benavides.